Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio.
Glad that you're here with us. We're coming to you live from southern Mississippi. Our AccuWindow window forecast about 92 degrees, sunshiny here against the Gulf Coast. Our heart goes out to those that are on the East Coast that have had problems with the weather. Also, on Tuesday, there was a little bit of excitement in Virginia from a little earthquake. 5.9 on the scale, kind of small by California standards, but record-breaking for Virginia. We understand they evacuated the Pentagon and several of the government buildings. Of course, you know, the inner rings of the Pentagon don't have any view of the yard. All they knew is the building was shaking. You can imagine some of the trauma that might have transpired on that day, and maybe some people took the day off the next day. Who knows? In any case, people scattered out into the streets. There were ambulances, helicopters, soldiers. All in all, though, a pretty good response. Not so much damage, not so much chaos. The solar wind is a blazing 374.5 kilometers per second, and the proton count is down to 1.1 photons per cubic centimeter, which means you are now approved, at least by this station, to go outside in a short-sleeved shirt. Sunspots 1277, 1279, and 1280 are active and will be facing Earth tomorrow. This morning at 0430 Universal Time, the magnetic canopy of departing sunspot 1271, you remember the one that launched a CME and an X-class flare that just missed Earth. It erupted, producing a B5-class solar flare and hurling a CME into space. As you know, that's way over on the western limb now. This beautiful blast was not directed at Earth, and it won't affect our planet, but we are watching it as it goes over the limb. In about 8 days, it will be coming back around. Sunspots are planet-sized islands of magnetism, floating in a fiery sea of solar plasma. They're not really like rocky, hard islands like Earth, but the firmament of sunspots is in a constant state of flux, constantly changing. Boiling motions in the underlying plasma cause sunspot magnetic fields to move and shift like amoeba, so that the active regions change shape on a daily basis, and now we're noticing they're changing almost on an hourly basis. And one of the strange things that we're seeing about sunspots, maybe it's because we're watching them more, but those of you that own Coronado scopes allow you to look directly at the sun with a telescope with the naked eye, right in the ocular. They're in two wavelengths, H-alpha and infrared, and you can really, I mean, if you ever get a chance to look at the sun through one of these, you have a friend that has one, don't pass it up, because it is nothing like looking at a photograph. Really, it's stunning. It is in motion. It is animated. It is like really nothing you've ever seen, and it fills the entire ocular. You almost can't take your eyes off of it. But we are now seeing this the way sunspots form. And they are changing their behavior. Now, it could be just because we're much more tooled up in this solar cycle 24 than we were in solar cycle 23 in the beginning. Or it could be that the sun actually is being influenced by some outside body, outside forces. And we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight here on X-Squared Radio. What we're seeing now are not just ordinary sunspots. They're not just, you know, one brown or black spot on the planet, sort of like a blemish. They are more like mud splatters. They're more like sunspot clusters. A giant sunspot with smaller sunspots around it, trailing behind it, being borne by it and traveling out into the plasma. And now we're seeing these high latitude, that is to say not equatorial, high latitude reverse polarity sunspots. We're seeing alpha, beta, gamma. We're seeing delta, gamma sunspots, several different wavelengths of sunspots coming on at the same time. And we're seeing filaments begin to form between these sunspots. They're sort of like ropes or ribbons that form in the plasma and go out at the one another. And these filaments can be very long, hundreds of thousands of miles long. And as they are, they hold a tremendous amount of energy. And as long as they stay stable and behave themselves, we're pretty much safe on our Earth. We just have an ordinary sun in the sky. But if the filament snaps, it's sort of like a giant crack the whip. And as the filament snaps, it throws plasma out into space at high velocity, millions of miles sometimes. And if it's facing Earth, we're in line to get hit by that in, you know, about 72 hours or less. As those high-energy particles come into our magnetic field of Earth, they're scattered around and have a tendency to be routed around the planet as highly charged oxygen particles, and they give off light called the aurora borealis. But if it's a direct hit, they will come through the magnetosphere, they will come through the ionosphere, and they will hit the upper atmosphere, forming cosmic rays. Now, those cosmic rays do emanate to Earth in the form of some high-altitude clouds, some as a shortwave radiation, and some are high-energy particles. Particles actually reach the planet and strike the planet and can cause chemical reactions. And as you know, all you really have to do is look in the mirror or just think about it. You are one walking blaze of chemical reactions. You have a lot of chemical reactions going on inside of you, human being. You're just a walking laboratory with all kinds of very neat spectrometers operating full-time. Those chemicals in your body are affected by these frequencies and by these particles that come into our atmosphere, and it is a universal effect. And being aware of it, however, does sort of empower you so that you can say, hey, I know why I'm feeling some new anxiety today. It isn't my dog, it's not my son, and isn't my boss. I'm feeling the same thing everybody else is feeling. And so I can consciously choose not to have those feelings. I can take control of myself. I can calm myself down, or you can calm someone else down. And it's that's how we keep our cool while the sun is getting hot. And that's not all that's in the sky. Blazing with the fury of a mini sun, a suspected meteor streaked across the sky over the city of Cuzco in Peru. It was captured blasting through the upper levels of the atmosphere at 2 p.m. in the middle of the afternoon, leaving an iridescent trail in its wake. I remember when I was a kid, we had a fireball that very slowly traversed across the sky, about what you would believe would be a supersonic jet going across the sky. It didn't make any sound, but this thing was on fire, and it was in the middle of the day. We didn't have any spacecraft in those days. This was the mid-60s, and this was something that literally froze people in their tracks on the sidewalk. They did not know what to do. We just looked up at it and watched it go by. Of course, it just glanced off our atmosphere and headed out into the nethermost regions of space. It didn't strike Earth at all, but it sure looked like it was going to strike right over by the elementary school. It was really close. Astonished residents in Peru watched as the impressive natural phenomena eventually disappeared over the horizon. Experts believe it may have caused forest fires to the south of the city, which have been ravaged by drought. Local officials and the national police are currently trying to determine where the meteorite may have landed and are speaking to farmers south of the city. The meteorite fell in the south of the imperial city between the districts of San Sebastian and San Geronimo. Cusco is the gateway to the Inca citadel of Machu Picchu. The Inca Trail attracts tens of thousands of tourists every year, with entry restricted to 200 new travelers each day. You can imagine how long that line can get at times. Peru last saw a meteorite fall in September of 2007 near the border with Bolivia. The basketball-sized meteorite left an impressive crater back then that was 44 feet in diameter. Fragments of rock tested positive for iron, nickel, and cobalt, with, of course, traces of iridium. It was dated at about 4.5 billion years old, which is about the age of the Earth, and formed around the same time as our solar system. Kind of interesting. Well, speaking of time, we don't usually do this on this program, but I had a listener send me this, and you hear this sometimes on other programs where they will say, this time last year, this is what happened, and so-and-so had a birthday on this day in 1889, and blah, blah, blah. Well, it's now 2011. We have a lot of things coming to fruition now. We have a chance at retrospection. We can look back at our earthly society 100 years, let's say, back to the year 1911. And, you know, there are some differences now to then. Yes, we had cars then, but they weren't like now. I mean, the cars back then were fragile and one of a kind and kind of an anomaly. And there were some other changes. You know, the average life expectancy for men in 1911 was only 47 years. 47 years. That's a kid anymore. I mean, 47 is the new 25. Fuel for cars in 1911 was not gasoline. Fuel was sold in drugstores only. Cars ran on alcohol. Only 14% of homes had a bathtub in 1911. Only 8% of the homes had a telephone. And, you know, speaking of cars today, I don't know how many cars there are in our country. I know there are some 150 million that drive every day on American roads to commute back and forth to work. Probably another 8 or 9 million that do all kinds of commercial work in our country. But in 1911, there were only 8,000 cars. That's it, only 8,000 cars. And in the entire country, there was only 144 miles of paved roads. That's it. I mean, there are 144 miles of paved roads in a single county in our country now. Don't tell me we haven't laid some serious asphalt in the last 100 years. The maximum speed limit in most cities for cars was 10 miles an hour. And by the way, if it came to an intersection, one of the occupants of the car had to step out in an intersection and ring a bell or honk a horn so that anyone riding a horse coming from one of the crossing directions could be alerted that a car was coming through, because, you know, the exhaust was rather loud. They didn't really have mufflers in those days. It was just a straight pipe from the internal combustion engine to the back of the car. So the exhaust systems rotted out in no time at all, because, as you know, when you burn alcohol, the byproduct is CO2 and, you got it, water. And we didn't know anything about galvanization then, so iron just rusted through in pretty much no time. So it didn't take too long before you really had to have a new piece of pipe put on your vehicle to get the exhaust out the back end. The tallest structure in the world in 1911 was the Eiffel Tower, which a lot of people know to this day has never been finished. It's true. The Eiffel Tower in Paris, France, was originally designed by the architect to be skinned in stainless steel, but they ran out of money. And so the Eiffel Tower that you see today is just the skeleton of the Eiffel Tower. It was so unique and so well received by the people as an icon of French ingenuity that they left it just the way it is. The average U.S. wage in 1910, going into fiscal year 1911, was just 22 cents per hour. Actually, not much less than it is now, 22 cents per hour. The average U.S. worker made between $200 and $400 per year. And to talk to a lot of average U.S. workers today, they don't think they're making much more than that now. A competent accountant, now keep in mind that might be an oxymoron, a competent accountant, could expect to earn up to $2,000 a year, and a dentist $2,500 a year, a veterinarian between $1,500 and $4,000 a year, and a mechanical engineer about $5,000 a year. That's just slightly more than mechanical engineers make today. More than 95% of all births, human births, took place at home. True. 90% of all doctors had no college education. Instead, they attended so-called medical schools, many of which were condemned in the press and the government as substandard. Compared to what? Substandard compared to what? That's what I'd like to know. Sugar in 1911 cost 4 cents a pound. Eggs were 14 cents a dozen. Coffee was 15 cents a pound. Most women only washed their hair once a month and used borax or egg yolks for shampoo. Canada passed a law that prohibited poor people from entering into their country for any reason. And there are countries that still have those laws. For instance, Australia will not allow you to migrate, that is, to move to Australia. You can visit as a tourist, no problem. You can come there and work for 30 days, no problem. But if you want to go there to live, you have to prove that you have a net worth, cash net worth of at least $100,000, or you have to commit to creating jobs if you come to Australia. And they don't allow anyone over the age of 40 to migrate to Australia. Just thought you should know. That's on their website. Check it out. In 1911, the five leading causes of death were pneumonia and influenza, tuberculosis, diarrhea, heart disease, and stroke. I think you could probably reverse those five, and that's the five leading causes of death today, except in place of tuberculosis, we would put video games. And that would be pretty accurate for today. In 1911, the American flag had 45 stars. The population of Las Vegas, Nevada was only 30. Crossword puzzles, canned beer, and iced tea hadn't been invented yet. And there was neither a Mother's Day nor a Father's Day. 2 out of every 10 adults could not read or write. That's 20%. And only 6% of all Americans had graduated from high school. As you remember, in 1911, most schools only had one room. And it was kindergarten through 8th grade. Marijuana, heroin, and morphine were all available over the counter at the local corner drugstores. And there was no drug war. Back then, pharmacists said, heroin clears the complexion, gives buoyancy to the mind, regulates the stomach and bowels, and is, in fact, a perfect guardian of health, close quote. of course, in those days, they didn't have to talk about the side effects. You know, ask your doctor about heroin. Side effects may include, well, there you go, rotting teeth, death. There you go. They didn't have to talk about the side effects. There was 8 times the amount of greenhouse gases being produced by industry, with the majority of industrial waste, that's heavy chemicals and solids, being dumped directly into rivers and streams. That's a big no-no today. You can still catch a perch out of the river and probably eat it today. The rivers are much, much cleaner than they are, or than they were then. We have made great strides in learning to live within the parameters of Mother Nature in the last 100 years. And there were about 230 reported murders in the entire USA. That's quite a statement, given that in the first year of the Iraq War, more Americans were killed in Chicago. More Americans were killed in Chicago by homicide than died in Baghdad. Quite an amazing statement. All right, we'll take about 1 minute, and we'll be back with tonight's first subject. Scientists find an underground river beneath the Amazon. We'll be right back. Don't go away. X Squared Radio coming your way. Oh, that's right, I forgot. We're on the phone, not on Skype, so you can't hear this music that I can hear. And I'm not very good at humming it, so we'll just get right into it. Scientists found an underground river beneath the Amazon River. Kind of interesting. Brazilian scientists have discovered an underground river some 4,000 meters, that's 13,000 feet, underneath the Amazon River, which flows from west to east, just like the country's famous waterway. A statement this week from Brazil's National Observatory named the underground river Hamza and said it represents one of two different draining systems for the large rainforest region. A team of scientists led by Elizabeth Pimentel came to the conclusion from studying 241 wells that were drilled by the state oil giant Petrobras in the Amazon region. By the way, 13,000 feet is not that deep. We have many, many wells in the United States that go deeper than 18,000 feet, and the Russians are now down to 42,000 feet. They're looking for the mother lode of what's called abiotic oil. That is to say, oil is not formed from dinosaurs. Oil is formed from a chemical process deep within the earth, bubbles up into voids and ancient layers and strata in the mantle, and then we drill into that and say that there are ancient lake beds full of decaying cellulosic sources like plants and animals and our plants and biological things like animals. I still remember the commercials back in the 70s from, I think it was Sinclair, used to have the symbol of the dinosaur that went into the earth and became the oil. And Gulf released some studies that algae was responsible for oil, which I think that's pretty plausible. But the idea that there's abiotic oil miles and miles and miles beneath the earth, which we've only drilled about 8 miles into the earth, so don't really sweat it, people. The crust is about 1,000 miles or 1,200 miles thick, so we haven't even scratched the surface. If they do find the mother load of oil, heaven help us all, because we'll burn it. Yeah, we'll make some plastic. We'll make a few computer cases and pairs of tennis shoes and polyester stockings with the oil that we find, but the rest we're going to burn. I hope they don't find it. I hope that we work our way to an alternative fuel. I hope that we grow up a little bit and learn that the internal combustion engine burning gasoline is not a very bright idea. Internal combustion engine burning alcohol, that sounds pretty good, because the CO2 made by the bacteria that make the alcohol was just returned into the atmosphere by burning the alcohol in the first place. The CO2 made by burning biodiesel is the same CO2 that was sequestered by the very plants that made the biodiesel, so it's a wash. We just don't add any more CO2 to the planet, but we convert seeds into energy, and the CO2 we put back in the atmosphere is eaten right back up by the same plants to make more sugar, and we have created the perfect renewable energy. We grow our fuel instead of killing each other over it. As you know, diamonds are a girl's best friend, so they say. Actually, I think possibly boys are girls' best friends, but you've heard of a field of diamonds, which are supposedly a rare and precious stone for which millions have been exploited over the centuries. Well, astronomers have spotted an exotic planet that seems to be made of diamond, racing around a tiny star in our galactic backyard. Don't get excited. Don't get excited. Hold on. Before you get your investors together, listen to the rest of the story. The new planet is far denser than any known so far and consists largely of carbon. Because it is so dense, scientists calculate the carbon must be crystalline. So a large part of this strange world will effectively be diamond. The evolutionary history and amazing density of the planet all suggest it is comprised of carbon. For example, a massive diamond orbiting a neutron star every 2 hours in an orbit so tight it would fit inside our own sun, says Matthew Bales of Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne. Now, this is why I suggest that you just simmer down. Don't call your investor buddies. Don't put together a ship. Go hack off a 6-pound chunk of this planet. It's 4,000 light years away, or around an eighth of the way toward the center of the Milky Way from the Earth. That's what we meant by galactic backyard. The planet is probably the remnant of a once massive star that has lost its outer layers to the so-called pulsar star it orbits. Pulsars are tiny dead neutron stars that are only about 20 kilometers, that's about 12 and a half miles in diameter, and it spins hundreds of times a second, emitting beams of radiation, sort of like a little motor out there generating a radio signal, hundreds of times a second. Now, that's a spinning planet. That's what happens when an ice skater pulls her arms in as she's skating. She spins faster and faster and faster because of conservation of momentum. In the case of pulsar J1719-1438, yes, you'll have to remember that. There will be a test later. The beams regularly sweep the Earth and have been monitored by telescopes in Australia, Britain, and Hawaii, allowing astronomers to detect modulations due to the gravitational pull of its unseen companion planet. So cool. The measurements suggest the planet, which orbits its star every 2 hours and 10 minutes, has slightly more mass than Jupiter, but is 20 times as dense. Bales and colleagues reported in the journal Science on Thursday. In addition to carbon, the new planet is also likely to contain oxygen, which may be more prevalent at the surface and is probably increasingly rare toward the carbon-rich center. Its high density suggests the lighter elements of hydrogen and helium, which are the main constituents of gas giants like Jupiter, are not present, long since consumed or stripped away. Just what this weird diamond world is actually looking like close up, it's a mystery. And I doubt we'll send a ship up there to see. 4,000 light years is just a little bit further than we can travel. Ben Stappers of the university says, in terms of what it would look like, I don't know. I couldn't even speculate. So, interesting story out there. By the way, I would like to open the phone lines. We're about 20 minutes away from the top of the hour. Sorry we got started late. I'm going to make the call one more time. If you have stock in Comcast, sell it. They're really leaving third world countries behind when it comes to effective internet service. All things notwithstanding, we have had, if you really want to call it a hurricane, hit the eastern seaboard, okay, I'll capitulate. But it's slightly insulting to those people that live down here on the Gulf Coast. That was an afternoon thunderstorm compared to what these people saw in 2005. And there was a little earthquake up there that kind of shook the cell phone towers and made it do some really strange stuff. By the way, there are companies out there that track and report on dropped cell phone calls. That's true. You don't even have to call in. They monitor it. They know when a cell phone call drops. It has a really weird kind of signal that sounds something like, yeah, it sounds like that. Anyway, they monitor that. And dropped cell phone calls are up 67% this month. That's not a quality control problem, people. That's a catastrophic failure of a system. And that sounds to me a little bit like solar radiation messing with satellites to me. There have not been enough bad weather events and enough earthquakes and enough other things to mess with cell phone coverage on Earth. Those kinds of effects happen extraterrestrially. It's just so you should know. So when you drop that Verizon call, Sprint call, AT&T call, T-Mobile, whatever, Cellular South, don't blame the cell phone company. Drop cell phone calls are up 67% for the month of August. Our phone numbers, if you want to reach us anywhere on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us. And no excuses, because there are two communication satellites orbiting Mars as we speak. So you can reach us, 530-413-4511. 530-413-4511. Some of you are out and about and have a curious smile on your face because you're listening to X Squared Radio using your Bluetooth. You can join your friends that are doing that by calling 760-569-7676. 760-569-7676. And then you have to dial the access number 192-919. I'll give you a chance to write that on your palm or the palm of the person that's driving the car. 192-919#, and then you can listen to X Squared Radio via your Bluetooth device. If you don't have a cell phone with unlimited minutes on nights and weekends, you can reach us toll-free anywhere in North America. The number is 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471, and you can join us tonight. We're kind of covering current events, but in the second hour, we're going to get into a little deeper some results that have come out on Comet Elenin. I know we've covered this from time to time over the last month and a half. As more information comes in, I'm going to bring it to you one program at a time. If you have any information, if you are lucky enough or fortunate enough or industrious enough to have a 10 or 12-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain scope out there, and you've got the coordinates of Elenin programmed into your unit, and your unit is connected to your computer, and you are taking stacked digital images night after night, and you have some tracking information. Gee, that's a lot of ifs, isn't it? But we do have hundreds of thousands of listeners all over the world, so someone out there has this equipment. And you've got some information on Elenin, and feel free to share it here. We will hold nothing back. Imagine forecasting a hurricane in Miami weeks before the storm was even a swirl of clouds off the coast of Africa. Before the butterfly ever took off from the lotus flower and started the chain of events that would be a hurricane. Or predicting a tornado in Kansas from the flutter of a butterfly's wings in Texas. These are the kind of forecasts meteorologists can only dream about. Could the dream come true? A new study by Stanford researchers suggests that such forecasts may one day be possible. Not on Earth, but on the Sun. Stathis Leonidis, a PhD student at Stanford University, says, "We have learned to detect sunspots before they are visible to the human eye. This could lead to significant advances in space weather forecasting. Sunspots are the butterfly's wings of solar storms. Visible to the human eye as dark blemishes on the solar disk, sunspots are the starting points of explosive flares and coronal mass ejections that sometimes hit our planet 93 million miles away. Consequences range from northern lights, which are kind of entertaining, to radio blackouts, like we're experiencing right now with Comcast, to power outages. Astronomers have been studying sunspots for more than 400 years, and they have pieced together their basic characteristics. Sunspots are planet-sized islands of magnetism that float in solar plasma. We report on them every Sunday night at the beginning of the program. And analyzing them has become a science. It's a technique called time-distance helioseismology. That's H-E-L, you get it. And it's similar to an approach widely used in earthquake studies, such as seismic waves traveling through the body of Earth. It reveals what's inside the planet. Well, sort of. It reveals what's inside the planet. I mean, it really does reveal what's inside the planet. It's just reported wrong. Acoustic waves traveling through the body of the sun can reveal what's inside the star. Fortunately for helioseismologists, how would you like to have that job title? John Doe, helioseism. What do you do for a living? I'm a helioseismologist. A helio what? A seiso who? Yeah. The sun has acoustic waves in abundance. Those are sound waves. The body of the sun is literally roaring with turbulent, boiling motions. This sets the stage for early detection of sunspots. Leonidis goes on, "We can't actually hear these sounds across the Gulf of Space, because nobody can hear you scream in space. But we can see the vibrations they make on the sun's surface." That's a little bit like in the movie Eagle Eye. You remember that? Where it looks, the instrument looks through the window and sees the vibration of the human voice on the surface of the cup of coffee in the room. And by looking at those vibrations, can tell what's being said in the room. Oh, yeah, way cool. Instruments on board two spacecraft, the venerable Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, that's SOHO, that's the old one. It's kind of an infrared chip. And what they do is they put a block, a round disc, over the sun, and that way they're just looking at the corona of the sun. And every few hours, they have to bake out that disk so that they can tell the difference between what's happening on the sun and the coldness of space. It's limited, but it has been our only source of information up until the newer Solar Dynamics Observatory, that's the SDO, was put up there to constantly monitor the sun for acoustic activity. Now, the Solar Dynamics Observatory is stereographic. It looks through a couple of sets of detectors, and it gives us a much richer real-time view of the actual surface of the sun. We can actually see the jet stream of the sun. We can see how the atmosphere of the sun moves and reacts to the shock waves of these filaments as they snap. Submerged sunspots have a detectable effect on the sun's inner acoustics, namely sound waves travel faster through a sunspot than through the surrounding plasma. A big sunspot can leapfrog an acoustic wave by 12 to 16 seconds. By measuring these time differences, we can find the hidden sunspot. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? It's like sound travels at about 700 miles per hour in air, but it travels at vastly different speeds in water or in earth or in solid metal. And so you'd be able to tell the difference just by time differences, whether the sound was traveling in water or whether it was traveling in the atmosphere. That's kind of a neat idea, very innovative. Leonidas says the technique seems to be most sensitive to sunspots located about 60,000 kilometers beneath the sun's surface. Wow. The team isn't sure why that is the magic distance, but it is a good distance because it gives them as much as 2 days advance notice that a spot is about to reach the surface. And the nice thing about the observatory is it can almost see over the horizon relative to Earth, and it can see what's coming over the eastern limb of the sun. Professor Phil Scherer of the Stanford Physics Department says, this is the first time anyone has been able to point to a blank patch of sun and say, a sunspot is about to appear right there. It's a big advance, people, big advance, because the size and location and charge and energy of these sunspots is becoming critical to conditions here on Earth. If we have solar conditions reach a certain level, it can wipe out our satellites, or at least take them offline for a while, which can wipe out our cell phones, our GPS, which our airplanes work with. We have literally hundreds of thousands of RFID chips on the Earth that use that GPS data to locate packages, shipping containers, trucks, documents, all kinds of stuff. Not humans yet. We're getting there, but not yet. As well as all kinds of farm animals. Every farm animal in the country now has an RFID chip slipped underneath the skin. If it wasn't for that law passed by the Department of the Interior, the RFID chip business would have gone out of business. There just wasn't enough demand. I mean, it's nice to know where a shipping container is, but at those prices, for the electronics, it just wasn't feasible. Once the Department of Interior passed a law that all domesticated animals, not cats and dogs, but that's coming, but, you know, sheep, cattle, horses, pigs, et cetera, all have to have RFID chips, that's what saved the industry, because now all those farmers have to buy those chips. That's driven the price down, the size down, made everything much more accessible, and now the market has literally exploded for RFID chips. And it won't be much longer. I mean, it'll just take one act of terrorism, and every citizen is going to have one. And they're going to be impossible to counterfeit, which means if you're an illegal and you're in this country, oh, you're going to be so easy to spot with a hand scanner. It'll be over for you. There are limits to this technique, cautions Leonidas. We can say that a big sunspot is coming, but we cannot yet predict it if it is a particular sunspot that will produce an Earth-directed flare. No, you can't, but it's better to know that a sunspot's coming. It's kind of like, we know where a tornado is going to happen, but we don't know if it's going to hit the town square or not. Just knowing that there's a tornado and knowing what the proximity of it is, whether it's near the city or out in the middle of nowhere, is a nice piece of information, Mr. Leonidas. So we applaud you and your study of the sun. In such a short amount of time with the SDO, you've been able to do that. So far, they have detected 5 emerging sunspots. That's not bad for less than a year and a half of operation. They did 4 with SOHO, and they did 1 with the SDO. But the SDO has only been up for a very short amount of time. And SOHO doesn't really look at the surface of the sun, or should I say it doesn't really report on the surface of the sun. It's more of a coronal reporter. So that's quite interesting that they're able to report that. That must mean that they're reading a lot more with SOHO than what they're telling us. Of those 5, 2 went on to produce X-class flares, the most powerful kind of solar explosion. This encourages the team to believe their technique can make a positive contribution to space weather forecasting, because helioseismology, gosh, I think that's just such a cool job title. This encourages the team to believe their technique can make a positive contribution. I believe that too. He goes on to say, we don't have enough CPU cycles, but he believes it's just a matter of time before refinements in their algorithm will allow routine detection of hidden sunspots. I think that's a big advantage for us. It's really going to help us out. We will take a break now. I'm going to play music for the recorded side of the program. You that are listening on BBS Radio Network are listening to me via cell phone. That's why the difference in the sound quality today. So I apologize on behalf of Comcast, but that's just the way it is. This side of town gets the short end of the internet. So we'll be back in about 3 or 4 minutes with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away.
The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared.
Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio.
Expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're so glad that you could be with us tonight. We're coming to you live from the southern Mississippi down near the Gulf Coast. And our AccuWindow forecast tonight is about, it's about 80 degrees now. Far from the weather woes of the East Coast, our hearts go out to those people that have had losses, pets, houses, people, whatever. Hope that everything comes out okay out there. We know that government might be a little bit slow to respond. And we hope that you've been listening to this program and have had your 72-hour kit ready at the wait, because you never know when one of these events is going to happen. Of course, many, many PSAs, public service announcements, were made to try to get you ready for the events that were coming with Hurricane/Tropical Storm Irene. Keep in mind, this is just August. You know, there is more to come, I can assure you. But if you were listening to this program, you probably have yourself prepared, because you probably went to our friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com and picked up your 72-hour kit, or you were even more industrious and you went to some of the online sites and purchased yourself a pail of 270 dehydrated meals, a nice Katadyn filter that you can make 2 quarts a minute of water from any kind of water. Literally, you could drop it down in a polluted pond, produce the filtered water, run it into a glass, and drink it. If you had been listening to this program, you would have been prepared. And if you weren't listening to this program, then you may have been prepared too. But now you're listening, and I'm trying to tell you that it's about time that that you got prepared. We're going to cover some controversial stuff in this hour after this first news story. The reason I'm going to cover it is because it's from my good friends from Gibson Guitar in Nashville, Tennessee. And just give you an idea of how, I'm not going to use the word intrusive. I'm going to say maybe overreaching government agencies can be in their zeal to, quote unquote, protect the planet in the name of whatever. I don't know. And that's okay. I appreciate the controversy. I appreciate the value of the controversy. My desire is to arouse your faculties, get you thinking about it, get you watching some of the nuances of the news or things that you see on Discovery History, Nat Geo Channel, Science Channel, or even in movies, so that you can discern truth from disinformation. And if you have run across any of that, I would sure appreciate you telling me about it or your feelings about it. Our phone numbers are anywhere on planet or off planet. And I'm telling you, you have no excuses. We have communication satellites as far out as 23,500 miles and all the way out orbiting Mars. So if you're anywhere in between, you can reach us. 530-413-4511. 530-413-4511. Those of you that are running around town or out on your moped or riding a bike or jogging, you could be listening to the program at 760-569-7676, dialing the access code 192919#. You can't interact with the program, but you can definitely share what we're talking about and listen, of course, to all the callers, just by dialing that number. If you don't have free nights and weekends on that cell phone, you're on a landline. By the way, only half of households in America have a landline anymore. Say, what's a landline? What's a curly cord? What does that mean? Well, if you happen to have that kind of phone system, you can call us at 888-429-5471 anywhere in North America, toll free. We'll pay the bill. No problem. You can join us. Those are the numbers for how to join me here on X Squared Radio. We do have multiple lines, so we have no qualms with having multiple guests on at the same time, as long as y'all get along. Start arguing too much because we've aroused your faculties. And by the way, in the religious communities, we call that bashing. But here, we're just arousing your faculties and getting you to think about the origin of truth. And if we go past your imagination a little bit, it's no problem. No problem. You should be wearing your seatbelt anyway while you're leaning back looking out the window as part of this program. Federal agents, men in black, swooped in on my good friends at Gibson Guitar Wednesday of this week, raiding factories and offices in Memphis and Nashville where my buddies work, seizing several pallets of wood, electronic files, and guitars. Yes, guitars. The feds are keeping mum. But in a statement yesterday, Gibson's chairman and CEO, Henry Juskowitz, defended his company's manufacturing policies, accusing the Justice Department of bullying the company. No. Yes. Quote, the wood the government seized Wednesday is from a Forest Stewardship Council certified supplier, close quote, he said, suggesting the feds are using the aggressive enforcement of overly broad laws to make the company cry uncle. It isn't the first time that agents of the Fish and Wildlife Service, oh yeah, the Fish and Wildlife Service, let me tell you, those are the bad boys. I'm telling you, the men in black go up in rank to the absolute echelon of the Fish and Wildlife Service. Oh, yeah. What? No, don't laugh. If you've ever been out hunting without a deer tag or a hunting license, you'll know what I'm talking about. Oh, they show up. They take your truck. They take your guns. There's no due process. By the way, you will never see that gun again, and you may never see your truck again. And you'll still have to make the payments on it, boys. Yeah, this is the upper echelon. I mean, if there is one above this, it's got to be UFOs or something. Fish and Wildlife Service is the bad boys of government. Anyway, they've come knocking at the storied maker of such iconic instruments as the Les Paul electric guitar. Such a sweet sound. The J160E acoustic electric, that's the one John Lennon played, and essential jazz boxes such as Charlie Christian's ES-150. Oh my gosh, not the ES-150. It's true. In 2009, the feds seized several guitars and pallets of wood from a Gibson factory, and both sides have been wrangling over the goods in a case with the delightful name, oh, you're going to like this, these crafty, ironic, merciless agents of the Fish and Wildlife Service. The name of the case is the United States of America versus Ebony Wood in various forms. Wow, is that not the perfect name for a jazz album? Sweet. Huh. The question in the first raid seemed to be whether Gibson had been buying illegally harvested hardwoods from protected forests, such as the Madagascar ebony that makes for such lovely fretboards. Wow, you'd think those folks down at Madagascar would say, you know, we do make the best ebony in the world, guys. What we should do is we should grow these trees. We should farm these trees instead of having them, you know, protected, extended, instead of having them go on the verge of extinction. Why don't we get, like, you know, little starts off of it or seeds? Wow, that would be a great idea. And we'll plant them, you know, like new trees, and we'll make money off of it. What a great idea. We get the guitars and the trees. My goodness. And if Gibson did knowingly import illegally harvested ebony from Madagascar, That wouldn't be a negligible offense. Peter Lowry, ebony and rosewood expert at the Missouri Botanical Garden, says the Madagascar wood trade is the equivalent of Africa's blood diamonds. But with the new raid, the government seems to be questioning whether some wood sourced from India met every regulatory jot and tittle. Oh, we're talking about I dotting and T crossing here. Wait till you hear this. I mean, you guitar players out there, I'm telling you, you better listen closely. It isn't just Gibson that is sweating. Musicians who play vintage guitars and other instruments made of environmentally protected materials are worried the authorities, those bad boys down at Fish and Wildlife, may be coming for them next. Oh, yeah, they're not just going after the manufacturers. Listen up. If you are the lucky owner of a 1920s Martin guitar, it may well be made in part of Brazilian rosewood. Cross an international border with an instrument made of that now restricted wood, and you better have correct and complete documentation proving the age of the instrument. Otherwise, you could lose it to a zealous customs agent who, I might add, will be richly rewarded by the Fish and Wildlife. Oh, yeah. Not to mention, you're going to face fines and prosecution. They're going to cast lots over your clothes, my friends. So if you're thinking about playing a gig down in Mexico or up in Toronto, you better not take that guitar with you. Not the one with the Brazilian rosewood. You're going to be in big trouble. It doesn't stop there. I got more. John Thomas, a law professor at Quinnipiac University and a blues and ragtime guitarist, says there's a lot of anxiety, and it's well justified. Once upon a time, he would have taken one of his vintage guitars on his travels. Now, he says, I don't go out of the country with a wooden guitar. The tangled intersection of international laws is enforced through a thicket of paperwork. Recent revisions to 1900's Lacey Act require that anyone crossing the U.S. border declare every bit of flora or fauna being brought into that country, whether it's alive or dead, or laminated or varnished. One is under strict liability to fill out the paperwork, and without any mistakes. You better not misspell your name. You better not put down an address that's not on your driver's license or your passport. You better mark everything down. If it's a six string, you better put six string. It's not enough to know that the body of your old guitar is made of spruce and maple. What's the bridge made of? Do you know? If it's ebony, do you have the paperwork to show when and where that wood was harvested and when and where it was made into a bridge? That you don't. If the nut, that's the thing holding the strings at the guitar's headstock, is it bone or could it be ivory? Even if you have no knowledge, despite Herculean efforts to obtain it, that some of your guitar, no matter how small, was obtained illegally, you lose your guitar forever. And you'll be paying a hefty fine, so says Professor Thomas. He has written, oh, and you'll be fined $250 for that false or missing information in your Lacey Act import declaration. Oh, yeah. You want to smuggle dope across the border? That's minor compared to bringing your own guitar that you've owned for 30 years across the border after playing a gig down in Torreón. Consider the recent experience of Pascal Villard, whose Atlanta-area company, get this, A440 Pianos, imported several antique Bösendorfers. Mr. Villard asked officials at the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species how to fill out the correct paperwork, which simply encouraged them to alert U.S. Customs to give his shipment added scrutiny. And those pesky men in black down at Fish and Wildlife? Oh, yeah, they were right there. By the way, I happen to know some antique pianos are coming in. Yeah, some antique Burschendorfers are coming in. You better check them out. There was never any question that the instruments were old enough to have grandfathered ivory keys. But Mr. Villard didn't have his paperwork straight when the 24 federal agents came calling. Facing criminal charges that might have put him in prison for years, Mr. Villard pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor count of blatantly violating the Lacey Act. Oh, my gosh. And was handed a $17,500 fine and 3 years probation. Given the risks, why don't musicians just settle for the safety of carbon fiber? Why not? Just get a plexiglass, guitar. Some do. I mean, you see violins today that are made of steel and have all kinds of electronics to make up for the difference of the wood that makes up that wonderful sound that a guitar can, or a violin or viola or cello can have. Some do. But when concert pianist Jeffrey Sharkey moved to England 2 decades ago, he had Steinway replace the ivories on his piano with plastic. Still, musicians cling to the old materials. Last year, Dick Boak, director of artist relations for C.F. Martin and Company, those of you that own Martin guitars, I applaud you for sticking your thumb in the eye of Fish and Wildlife, complained to Mother Nature News about the difficulty of getting elite guitarists to switch to instruments made from sustainable materials. He says, surprisingly, musicians who represent some of the most savvy, ecologically minded people around are resistant to anything about changing the tone of their guitars. Oh, come on. You want to hear aristocracy? Here you go, people. You could mark that up to hypocrisy. Artsy do-gooders with too eager to tell others what kind of light bulbs they have to buy won't make sacrifices when it comes to their own passions. What a bunch of crap. Then again, maybe it isn't hypocrisy to recognize that art makes claims significant enough to compete with environmentalist agendas. Actually, I'm kind of torn. It's not that I'm an environmentalist. It's that I'm a sensible environmentalist. Harvesting something that grows naturally, if you can replace it with a younger, more vibrant, more healthy version of it by planting its seed back in the ground and letting it continue its genetics, makes a lot of sense. You know, in the upper Northwest, they're on their third and sometimes fourth cuttings of forests. Yeah, whole forests. They were clear-cut 70 years ago. New trees were planted. Those trees grew up. They were harvested. New trees were planted. They were harvested. And now they're on their third and sometimes fourth cuttings, and you know what? They're the healthiest forests in the world because there's no disease in the trees. The trees don't get so old that they rot. The trees don't get so old that they cover the canopy of the forest floor, not allowing other plants to grow. These are called managed farms. They could do the same thing in Madagascar. They could do the same thing in the rainforest. They could do the same thing in areas around the planet. We are not hunter-gatherers, people. We are domesticators. We are harvesters and planters. We are managers of our planet. So you folks down there at the Lacey Act Gestapo, lay off. Because I like hearing Martin guitars. I like hearing Gibson guitars. If there's a problem, why don't you take the $17,500 and buy some rosewood tree seeds and let's try planting them around the planet and maybe we can have our wood and eat it too. Sounds like a good idea. Okay. Interesting stuff coming out. You know, the internet is down here on our side of the city. Yes, it's true. One little anomaly and all the hotels on this side of town go dark. That's why Comcast. That was a Freudian slip. Sorry about that. Anyway, it's down. I have no internet service right now, and so we're coming to you live via AT&T. That's why our sound quality is just a little bit different, but I do encourage you to call nonetheless. 530-413-4511, anywhere near a cell phone tower, 888-429-5471, toll-free anywhere North America. CBS 5's Kia Du tested the Google Fiber Internet service. Oh, I just can't wait. I mean, I'm Pavlovian here, which is being offered for free in a neighborhood just south of Stanford University campus. I'm moving. That's it. I'm moving. Get this. Get this. Hold on. Hold on. No, no. You online gamers are going to love this. A 95 megabyte high definition movie trailer downloaded in about 9 seconds. 9 seconds? Can you believe it? Wow. CBSSF.com showed up in a blink. How about that? Download speeds on the network were up to 300 megabytes per second, with an upload speed of 150 megabytes per second. Do that. Compare those speeds to Comcast, where DO reports download speeds of 13 megabytes, or about 1/20th the speed of Google Fiber. Kansas City is the only other place to receive Google Fiber. That's it. I'm moving. It's part of a grand experiment involving as many as 500,000 homes to improve ways to build the network. I wonder what apps people might invent when the speeds get going that fast. Wow. That's enough bandwidth to steer a satellite live. Wow. You can stream X Squared Radio. Oh, by the way, I wanted to tell you. Many of you have been writing me, and, you know, I'm not the most savvy webmaster in the world. We have made some changes. We've made some improvements. All the archives, 2008, 2009, 2010, are all live now. That's right. So if you have your X Squared Radio membership and you haven't been to the archives, 2007, 8, 9, or 10, get out there. Because they're out there. 2005 and 2006 archives are stored on an LG drive, which I bought brand new. Yes, brand new at Office Depot. It's a half a terabyte drive. Brand spanking new, plugged it into the computer, stored 2005 and 2006 archives on it, and that's the last time the drive worked. I have plugged that drive into half a dozen computers, and nothing can even recognize it. Whatever LG did to their hard drives a year ago, I would not recommend buying one. No, just don't buy it. That's my review. But all those archives are now live, so you can go there and listen to them. And there are lots out there. My gosh, we got the Tom Van Flander, we got L.A. Marzulli, who just came out with two new movies, The Watchers and The Watchers 2. Pretty well produced, about History Channel on steroids. Pretty good stuff. Very good video, decent interviews. He does a good job. We're going to get him on the program and talk about that. Good old L.A. Marzulli, we've had him on once before. And all of the old archives that have made X-Squared Radio famous on the Internet, they are now live again. Of course, you know, those of you that have been to xsquaredradio.com have seen the new website. Much, much improved thanks to my wonderful, wonderful webmaster assistant, Dylan Case. His link is on the website. Any of you thinking about upgrading your website, I'm talking major reasonable. Literally, you know, pay the guy a couple grand and you're really going to get a major animated GIF upgrade website, okay? Dylan Case. That's supposed to be applause. He really did a great job for X Squared Radio. Thank you so much, Dylan, if you're listening tonight. Thank you. I'm bowing right now. Palms up. Also, movie review. I just saw POTA. Excellent movie. POTA, Planet of the Apes, and the Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Good movie. Well-directed, excellent special effects, seamless CG, really seamless CG. Very emotional. Even the sign language between the primates was emotional. Good movie, good acting, well-directed, fairly good script. I think the screenplay was about as well done as any can be. And here's the kicker. The movie's been out for 3 weeks. It was sold out. Yeah, sold out twice. Had to get a movie, had to get a ticket for the next showing. And then that one sold out as well. Sitting in there, there were couples that came in that had to find another seat because it was sold out. They couldn't sit together. Terrible thing when you're seeing a movie like that. So good review, good review. And we're still working on the screenplay for the books. The screenplay is done, and the screenplay has been turned in to one of the producers, and the producer just flipped. He liked it a lot. Called me up and said, congratulations, you've written a major motion picture. I knew that. But no, I'm not being cocky. I'm just saying it's a good movie. I liked it. But as you know, there are 13,206 screenwriters in Los Angeles, and there are only 6 doorways that you can walk through. So it creates a little bit of a traffic jam, and I'm not willing to go to L.A. and take a job as a waiter with my screenplay on a thumb drive in my hip pocket where I could scan for my playing card list of producers, James Cameron a la, where I could run up and slide the thumb drive into their front pocket and say, hey, please look at this. I'll sign whatever paper you have to do. Let's get this movie made. I'm not going to do it. I wrote it. It was a good challenge. I appreciated it. Those of you that think it should be made into a movie, call your congressman. I'm kidding. Don't call your congressman. But if you know somebody in Hollywood that can get me past that 300-pound receptionist, you know, the one with no neck, I would really appreciate it. I just want to get behind the glass door with it. That's all I'm asking. Without question, we're shifting gears here. Cinch the seatbelt up a little tighter. Hang on a second. Time to take a sip of the frozen latte. Hold on. Wow. That's really good. That wasn't a sip. That was several gulps, but it's okay. Without question, Comet C2010X1. C2010X1. Okay, Elenin is a very important object and one that deserves close attention. We have given it some attention on this program, and I have to admit I'm a little skeptical. You know, I'm one of the ones that's kind of saying, okay, prove it. You know, we can't find Elenin. There's no pictures. I got my binoculars. I'm out there looking. There's a threshold that many call the 7x35. 7x35, that's a 7-power, 35-millimeter set of binoculars. That multiplies space 7 times into your eyes, much more than that, and you don't get enough field of view. You maybe get 1 star in the field of view at a time, and it's impossible to hold it still enough to see anything. And admittedly, what you're looking for is kind of a little fuzzball, a little cotton ball out there with its corona in space. But it's called the 7x35 threshold. If you can see it with a 7-power set of binoculars, then it's within range. That's where Hale-Bopp was. It's where, you know, some of the other marshmallow-sized comets have been, and we've been able to see them. And I've been a little bit skeptical because we didn't have any new data on Elenin. So I did some more research this week, and I have some underground people out there which shall remain anonymous because they want to be, because they think this is maybe something other than what we're going to discuss tonight. And if it is, it's all going to unfold, and very soon. It is long from being visible to the naked eye. And in the interim, we are, you know, presently seeing a lot of speculations, misinformation, and, of course, carefully crafted disinformation. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And we can follow it, and we're going to talk about it, and we want your thoughts on it. So be sure to call in if you know anything or suspect anything, or you just want to find out for yourself. Consequently, most people are in a quandary as to what this object actually is, myself included, because there are some things that just don't fit. Is Comet Elenin a clear and present danger, as many believe? Alternately, is it, as astronomers now tell us, a relatively young and interesting comet, but one that falls short of the criteria? A little bit like Hurricane Irene. Oh, it was a terrible 3 or 4, but by the time it hit landfall, it was a 2, and it's been kind of a piddly 1, really. And I think that's partially because of where it hit. Now, if you notice, when you were watching the Weather Channel, you were watching the Weather Channel. I saw you. Anyway, as you were watching the Weather Channel or checking it out on the Internet, you noticed that the hurricane was coming up the East Coast rotating counterclockwise, the same way all hurricanes rotate in the Northern Hemisphere. But as it came up the Eastern Seaboard, it ran into that pesky jet stream, which was dipping down low beneath Boston there. And it's pretty wide and pretty fast, pretty energetic, except that it sort of like put the brakes on that hurricane because it hit the top edge of the hurricane, which was, of course, you know, large in diameter. So the jet stream took the top half of the hurricane and peeled it off and forced it clockwise back out into the Atlantic. And so you had a counterclockwise hurricane spinning into a clockwise forcing jet stream. And it literally just ripped the thing apart. So that's why we just had a lackluster storm surge, a little bit of flooding in Pennsylvania. Nevertheless, my consolations go out to, my condolences go out to those that lost property, cars. I did see a few cars buried to the mirror. That's no fun. You know, just see if you can keep it out of Carfax, and maybe you can get rid of it with the slight water damage after you pump the water out of the motor. But it is one that falls short of what we consider a comet from Earth standards. Environmental News Network reported on May of this year. We're just kind of cover about 5 or 6 months of this thing. It was first detected on December 10th, 2010, so about 9 months ago, by Leonid Elenin, an observer in Lyubertsky, Russia. I never could speak Russian, sorry, who made the discovery using the ISON-NM observatory near Mayhill, New Mexico. Comet Elenin should be at its brightest shortly before the time of its closest approach to Earth on October 16th, 2011. That's right. At its closest point, it will be 22 million miles from Earth. That's a good piece, people. For a comet, that will have zero effect on us. That's like yelling at the top of your lungs in Little Rock and trying to be heard in Nashville. It ain't going to happen. It's 0.3 light years. Is well inside the Oort cloud, source of long period comets such as Comet Elenin and other objects as well. Alternative theories abound. These are some of the things that are out there on the web. You want to call in and discuss it, I'm happy to. You have any evidence, feelings, emotions, thoughts, premonitions, I'd love to hear it. Alternative theories abound, including those who believe it is A. No, this isn't multiple choice. This is a list. A, Planet X. B, the Nemesis dark star astronomers debated in the 1970s. C, the dark star, or the star of Bethlehem, to herald the second coming, also known as the sign of the Son of Man. D, an alien mothership under intelligent control. That's the one I'd vote for. E is the blue Kachina of the Hopi. And F is all of the above. Isn't all of the above most of the time the answer? Anyway, nonetheless, what do we see right now? Images on the Internet and sources and are often difficult if not possible to verify with any sense of certainty. And by the way, I really take exception to that statement, on the internet. That one prepositional phrase, oh, you got that, on the internet. Where did you get that information? On the internet. Well, I got to tell you people, if you said, well, my college professor told me, I would have less credulity. I would put less weight on what a college professor told me than what I learned on the internet. In fact, if you read about it in the library, in a book that was published from McGraw-Hill, I would put less credence in that than I would the internet. Because the internet is the modern-day Library of Alexandria. Yes, there's a lot of comic book stuff on there, but there's also enough information that you can cross-reference things. You can cross-think things. You can vet the sources. You can check out the instrumentation that they used. You can look at the quality of their writing, the quality of their reporting, their methodology. You can be intelligent, and you can be made more intelligent by information that's on the internet. So when you tell people where you got stuff, instead of saying on the internet, or instead of listening with the shudders of, oh, that came on the internet, listen to the website. If it sounds something like darkstarconspiracies.com, maybe you want to kind of look sideways at that. But if it came from JPL, if it came from Fox News, if it came from, one of the more mainstream sites, maybe you can knock the credibility of that up a couple notches. Maybe you can say, okay, that's either disinformation or it's legitimate. But it's not some channeler out there in Southern California saying that they saw it in a vision that this is the harbinger of death. And it's going to bring spray cyanide all over the planet and kill everyone. On the internet is a broad brush. So I'm just saying be a little bit more discriminatory when we're talking about this, especially with this Google speed coming up. My gosh, this Google fireball is going to be awesome. I can't wait. I'm moving. I'm telling you, I'm moving to Kansas. I'm going to buy a house in Kansas. I want that 300 megabytes per second. I'm Pavlovian here. I just can't believe it. Anyway, there's a process that leaves many feeling as though they're piecing together an immense tabletop puzzle. And the corner pieces are nowhere to be found. So you can't like start at a straight edge and start putting it together. In JPL's website, for instance, it quotes NASA astrobiologist David Morrison to say, and we've had him, we've had his recordings on the program. I get all kinds of mail from you guys. Thank you for putting him on the program because now we know where NASA stands. He really is an astrobiologist with NASA, but David Morrison, you got to get your facts right. This whole idea of telling everybody, go back to what you were doing, go back to the mall, everything's going to be fine, everything's under control, we know everything, we see everything, everything's fine. Come on, David. We're smarter than that. Here's what he says. As seen from the Earth, Comet Elenin will not cross the sun's face. But even if it could cross the sun, which it can't, he notes, the Comet Elenin is about 2 to 3 miles wide, that's about 3.5 kilometers, while the sun is roughly 865,000 miles across. So how could such a small object block the sun, which is such a large object? David, I can block the sun out with my thumb, okay? Okay, he kind of covers this, but I'm going to shoot holes in it anyway. He says, let's think about an eclipse of the sun, which happens when the moon appears between the Earth and the sun. The moon is about 2,500 miles in diameter and has the same apparent size as the sun, which is about 250,000 miles, or 250,000 miles away, roughly 100 times its own diameter. For a comet with a diameter of about 2 to 3 miles to cover the sun, it would have to be within 250 miles, roughly the orbital altitude of the International Space Station. However, as stated above, this comet will come no closer to Earth than 22 million miles. Well, that's interesting, Mr. Morrison. Very interesting for an astrobiologist to tell us such a thing. I'm going to let you wait for my response while I take another sip of this wonderful latte. Hold on. It's good stuff. The JPL website has an ephemeride program. This is a program where you can put in all the parameters and you can hit crunch and it will run real time and it will give you all the information that it has up to that moment. Well, I went to the JPL official website and I took advantage of the ephemeride program and I put in all the parameters for LNN that were available on the website, plugged them in, and it's kind of interesting what I got. Many people are trying to plot the orbit of the comet with the routine on the JPL website without realizing that this is just a simple visualization tool. While the tool has been recently improved to show smoother trajectories near the sun, it is not a scientific program to generate an accurate orbit. Yeomans is the guy that helped generate it. He explains that the orbit plotter on the near-Earth object website is not meant to accurately depict the true motion of objects over long time intervals, nor is it accurate during close planetary encounters. Close quote. Well, that's kind of concerning, Mr. Yeomans, because you're putting these plots up on the Internet, you're putting these plots up on your website at jpl.com, and you're showing people the expected trajectory of LNN as it comes into our solar system from a rather oblique angle, I might say. It is coming in not along the elliptic, that is to say, the plane of all the planets, plus or minus a few degrees out from the sun, you know, one at a time, you know, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, and so forth, all the way to Pluto, which here at X-Squared Radio is still a planet. So we have 9, not 8. It is coming from above the plane, and it will cross the plane of all the planets orbiting the sun. But there are a lot of forces working on this, and I have to say that they've looked out at it as it's traveling through space. And, it hasn't crossed the 7x35 threshold, but it should very soon. According to the actual JPL Ephemerides program, now I ran this myself. I went to their website just a few hours ago. I put in the location that they had on their own website, and I ran it. And I quote, are you ready? The center radius is the body known as LNN is not 2 to 3 miles. It is 6,378 kilometers, which is 3,963.1 miles. That's about 1.5 times the diameter of the moon. That's a little bit different than what Mr. Morrison told us in his quote. When people over the world are standing out in their backyards and observing this object with a common pair of binoculars, such as we use for sporting events, bird watching and the such, at that point we'll be admiring the view with copious outpourings of oohs and ahs, or nervously crapping our collective pants. Until then, this debate will continue to spin like a whirling dervish. But in the midst of all this speculation and theorizing and X-Squared Radio pontificating, yes, we pontificate here. We do not bloviate, but we do pontificate. One theory has yet to be proposed. That being that this object is not a clear and present danger, but rather a genuine object that by convenient coincidence has become a useful decoy. Dun, dun, dun. A decoy? Are you kidding me? No, I'm not. Assuming that Comet Elenin is, in fact, a convenient decoy for disinformationalists, which is not quite as interesting a job as a helioseismologist, then what could be the goal of this manipulation? Huh? Have you given that any thought? Have you followed the money? Oh, we're about to. I'm sure you have an opinion on it. 530-413-4511 or 888-429-5471. Uh-huh. Assuming such an effort is presently underway. I know it's an assumption, but, you know, we pesky scientists are always assuming things. Now, you can't really do that in human resources, but you're allowed to do it in science, and we're going to do it here because it's my program. Assuming such an effort is presently underway, it would obviously serve the following three goals. And I mean obviously. The natural disasters now being attributed by the approach of Comet Elenin could in fact be the result of another unseen or unforeseen causality. Another object approaching the core of our system that will achieve its closest distance to our sun long after Comet Elenin is well along the way. Back out to the hinterlands of our solar system, we will have long forgotten about Comet Elenin. And it may not be that long. It may only have to be a week or a month. You know how our news people are. If the batteries and their lights run a little bit low, hey, they hit the off light, and that's the end of the story. It's done. On to the next crisis. Two, assuming the goal of the disinformationalists is to quell public interest with a Comet Elenin non-event flyby when it passes closer to the Earth, makes it a perfect decoy or kind of a wolf cry. The sky is falling, the sky is falling. Oh, yeah, we heard that with Elenin. One that will have led countless people down unproductive rabbit holes, thereby exhausting their interest in the topic. The sky is falling. The sky is falling. The sky is... Who cares? It's football season. The result is that most will simply walk away in disgust. Why? Well, come on. You heard about it on the internet. And they'll not only walk away from the Comet Elenin discussion, but Planet X as well. Three, what is the point of this theoretical decoy exercise? To ensure the greatest number of casualties when the true causality wreaks havoc on our planet. The sky is falling, the sky is falling. Who cares? It's football season. Oh, my God. The sky is falling. Simply stated, Comet Elenin could be used as a decoy to further the aims of elites, the elect, the upper crust, the haves, to reduce global population in the most expeditious manner possible. I didn't make it up. I didn't make it up. This comes from disinformationalist.com, if there is such a website. I didn't make it up. There are people who really believe that the Earth is crowded. It's time to go back to wilderness, you know. I want to drive my, you know, Mercedes-Benz motorhome across the United States, and I don't want to see anything but woodlands, you know. I want to take a train ride, and I don't want it to ride through the backyards of poor people. You see how ridiculous this whole idea is? I mean, if we reduce the population of Earth by even 10%, who is going to bake the bread? Who's going to pump the gas? Who's going to make stuff? When you have a problem with your computer, who's going to fix it? I guarantee it's not going to be an elite. No way. It's going to be a geek down at Best Buy's. It's going to be the guy that works on laptops out of his attic He's not the elite. If your car breaks down, your fancy Audi, your Porsche, your Ferrari tears up, who's going to work on it? That's not going to be an elite. It's going to be a guy that knows how to do stuff. It's going to be a guy with grease under his fingernails. You see how crazy this idea is? But this is more on the number three. The fewer the survivors, the better, as feeding the current global population during a global cataclysm. And then, on in a post-historic world, is simply impossible. It's just not possible to feed all these people. Natural disasters worldwide are already impacting food production, reserves, and prices of food and fuel. And to this, the loss of the oil infrastructure, such as refineries, terminals, pipelines, etc., trucks, fuel stations, that oil-dependent agribusinesses interest depend upon, and the result will be starvation, chaos, lack of energy, anarchy, violence on a global scale. We've already seen it. I mean, come on, when these governments run out of the soup line money in London, you saw what happened. When the Greek government ran out of free handouts to people who retire at age 50, oh yeah, you can retire at age 50 in Greece, and free medical care for everyone. The country went broke, people. They went bankrupt. The checks they wrote were no good. The banks were empty. The people had literally exhausted government. Rather than produce on their own, they individually, very selfishly, voted for themselves a piece of the coffer, and they broke their country. And when they passed austerity measures, austerity, it means cutting the budget. It means mom is not going to give you an allowance for a few weeks while she saves up money to cover the bill. Got it? That's what austerity is. It means that you have to move back with your parents and mow the grass so that they don't have to pay the gardener, and they can give you some money so you can continue your acting classes. Austerity. That's what the government had to do. And, of course, the people were very peaceable, and, oh, they understood. Everything was fine. Bull. They went out and busted windows, and they burned cars, and they tried to burn the city down, and they looted by the thousands. Over 1,000 people in 1 week were arrested for larceny because their mug was right there on the camera. Smile as you take that TV out of the store. You might never get to plug it in because you're going to jail. I'm telling you right now, if you grow up thinking the world owes you a living, you're done. Or you're elite, one or the other. Anyway, assuming this decoy theory holds true, and I have to think there are a lot of folks living in the upper floors in London or the gated communities that would really have liked for about half those people that were tearing up London the other day to move away, to go back to the countries from which they came, because they came to London for a free handout. They wanted their bagel, they wanted their cream cheese and their fish and chips three times a day for free. The elite want them to go away. They produce nothing. Oh yeah, there's a big force about it. You don't believe me, go to any big city you want. Go ahead, try to walk up to the front door of a pro football player. No way. You're not going to get within three blocks of that place because there'll be a gate at the end of the street. Why? Because they're inside and you're outside. If they need you, they'll bring the Mercedes by the shop. There is a separation here. There is an animosity building. And if you feel this in this article, hey, call in and talk to me about it. It's the principal mechanism used by their disinformation minions. In a word, it is, I'm going to use it, one-ism. One-ism. Since the days when mankind finally figured out how to string guttural sounds together to form languages, our ancestors have sought simple answers to fundamental questions such as how we came to be and why the world is as it is. Lacking a scientific method and favoring simplicity, the answer always draws upon one single concept to connect all the dots, so to speak. Whether you believe in God, that he created all that we know in 6 days, or the great Flabaz shook a cosmic bush for fun, it makes no difference. It's all rooted in oneism, which works rather well when explaining issues while huddled around a campfire with meat on the spit. Even in this modern age, with all our fabulous technology, Google, it's coming. We still cling to the imagined oneism of our ancestors, as it is a very hard habit to break. Although we know better on one hand, on the other hand, we are all too easily lured in the direction of one simplistic answer, a quest that is all too often, it turns out to be a fool's errand. Because there is no one answer. It's chaotic. The only real changes the internet has brought to this ancient predisposition is immediacy. It's easy to get information. On the one hand, I agree with that. On the other hand, I disagree because the internet is actually allowing us to form a new neural network for the human race. We are now able to communicate real time just as we are right now. You're sitting out there all over the world listening live to Expert Radio. You're listening to these thoughts. You're being empowered by these viewpoints. And it's going to affect you. It's going to affect the universe. And we don't need much effect. We only need just about 2 or 3% of the population to understand these concepts. And we can take apart the system of aristocracy, and we can put back together a planetary viewpoint, not one world government. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about maybe a utopic idea of peace and cooperation, a population built on something else. And I'll go into a little bit more detail as we get into this idea of Elenin and what it's going to bring to us. If it comes within 22 million miles of Earth, if it's 2 to 3 miles in diameter, it's not going to be much of an event. If this program on the JPL website is accurate, and the diameter of this thing is actually 6,300 kilometers or 3,900 miles, we might have an issue on our hands. Not that the density or the gravity is any kind of issue. They've already watched it pass asteroids, and it's not perturbing their path whatsoever. So it's not going to have a big gravitational pull on us. But this thing's dragging, you know, an entourage behind it. The other little pieces are just as worrisome because their gravity, their size, their mass is small enough that they can get pulled out of their path, and we're not watching them. These are smaller pieces, maybe the size of a bus. All they have to do is get yanked out of their path and head our way and make their way into our gravitational pull, not in a Trojan-like way where they lag behind us in our own orbit, but they come at us in a, I'm going to call it a short warning path. Where it comes through space, it's not bright enough to reflect light where we can see it. It's coming at us from an angle that we wouldn't normally see light reflect on it. Somebody told me the other day, well, if it was out there and it was reflecting light, we'd be able to see it. Not so, people. Not so at all. Our own moon goes dark every 28 days. It's only 250,000 miles away and large enough to block out the entire sun. But if Earth blocks the light of the sun, you can't see it. It's a new moon. It's up there, but it's black. Unless you have infrared goggles, you're not going to see it. Well, that's the way these bodies are. If they're not reflecting the sun's light in our direction, it's coming at us from the shadow side. You're not going to see it. And judging on the credibility of our government agencies, not the Fish and Wildlife Agency, oh no, They would tell us the truth. Then we're not going to see it. We're not going to have any warning. Something the size of a bus coming into our atmosphere and striking anywhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in the middle of Nevada, in the middle of Nebraska, in the middle of Tibet, it's going to have cataclysmic effects on our planet. And an early warning system would be nice. Something to give us an idea we're in harm's way. That would be good. Well, we're going to take a quick break right now. I will let the studio play theirs. I'll play mine. We've got about 4 minutes. We'll go ahead and take a quick break here on X Squared Radio. I'll have a couple more sips. Phone lines will be open, of course, in the last hour. And we will continue with the Elenin saga. Hopefully we get a little more information. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio after this.
Our friends down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TVT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TVT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer.
There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today.
If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today.
The
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio.
Southern Mississippi. Nice clear skies down here tonight. Good sky watching weather. Our hearts go out to those that have had losses on the East Coast, either from the earthquake or from the anomalous Hurricane Irene tropical storm a la. In this hour, I'm going to cover some pretty controversial information. It's kind of a ratchet of articles that came out recently to explain what seems to be a pretty well-coordinated disinformation program. You know, there are two mysteries of 2009 regarding Comet Elenin. If one uses the JPL orbital simulator for Comet Elenin and then backs it up to the first half of 2009, Comet Elenin is shown as being just beyond the orbit of Saturn. Well, that may make sense for then. Then by August of 2010, it shows this object flew inside the orbit of Jupiter, where comets do light up and are discovered. This was the case when C2010X1 was subsequently discovered by Leonid Elenin in December of 2010. Yet, all of the planetary alignment earthquake theories for Comet Elenin failed to address the 2009 time frame. And two rather disturbing mysteries reported for that year by mainstream science. Oddly enough, these new disclosures combine to give credence, at least on a Hollywood level, for Roland Emmerich's blockbuster film, 2012, starring John Cusack. You remember that one? We thought, oh, gee, great CG. We thought, oh, he jumped on the 2012 bandwagon. He created this, you know, great sensational blockbuster that went out there and talked about how terrible the events of 2012 are going to be with a crustal shift and all of that. Well, released in late 2009, Emmerich's 2012 featured a star-studded ensemble cast weaving their way through a catastrophic pole shift. The film opens with a presentation of the scientific premise for the scenario that postulates, get ready, that a new form of neutrinos from the sun is causing the Earth's core to heat up. This, in turn, triggers the catastrophic Earth changes and the subsequent geophysical pole shift portrayed in the film. So it was all just, you know, Hollywood science and CG and a bunch of research that Emmerich put together. Or is there a deeper story and perhaps a coincidence? Ah, that's why you listen to this program. In the many months leading up to the release, several theories were bantered about by Sony's marketing spinmeisters, including a Planet X flyby, and consequently NASA's planned Planet X debunking of the film was pointless. Not that it stopped them from attacking a ghost premise of the film, which in fact never materialized. When the film was released, the premise that a new form of neutrinos was heating Earth's core was laughable for some and just good entertainment for others. Originally scheduled for release on July 10th, 2009, the film's actual release date was moved to November of 2009. Then, in the following month, a very interesting news story was published by National Geographic. Here's the story. December 24th, 2009, right after 2012 came out. Earth's North Magnetic Pole is racing toward Russia at almost 40 miles per hour. A year. 40 miles per year. Due to magnetic changes in the planet's core, new research says. The core is too deep for scientists to directly detect its magnetic field, but researchers can infer the field's movements by tracking how Earth's magnetic field has been changing at the surface and in space. Now, newly analyzed data suggests that there's a region of rapidly changing magnetism on the core's surface, probably being created by a mysterious plume of magnetism arising from deeper in the core. If this is interesting, then as the old saying goes, wait till the other shoe drops. Daily Galaxy, May 5th, 2011, 6 months later. Get this. Between May of 2009 and May of 2010, Ice Cube has detected 32 billion cosmic ray muons with a median energy of about 20 tera electron volts. That's a lot of power. That's a massive, massive muon, 20 tera electron volts. These muons revealed with extremely high statistical significance a southern sky with some regions of excess cosmic rays, hotspots, and others with a deficit of cosmic rays, cold spots. Over the past 2 years, a similar pattern has been seen over the northern skies by the Milagro Observatory in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and the Tibet Air Shower Array in Yangbajan. The mystery remains perplexing because the hotspots must be produced within about a 0.03 light-year distance from Earth. 0.03 light-years from Earth. You do a little calculating, it's not very far. Further out, galactic magnetic fields should deflect the particles so much that the hotspots would be smeared out across the sky. But no such sources are known to exist. There are three types of neutrinos: electron neutrinos, muon neutrinos, and tau neutrinos. In this case, this muon hotspot was some 0.3 light years away, which is well inside the Oort cloud. That's where comets originate from. It's nearly a light year away from our sun. It also happens to be the source of many long period comets, such as Comet Elenin, Halley's Comet, Leonid, and others. This brings us to an interesting 2012 movie, Conspiracy Question. How could Comet Elenin, assuming it is a brown dwarf star, and the source of the muon hotspot discovered in 2009 inside our solar system and which appeared concurrently with a mysterious plume of magnetism arising deep within the Earth's core, or, which it couldn't, because you would not be able to create hotspots from that far away. They'd be smeared all over the planet. Or is it something else? A reality that transcends all of these unanswered questions? And the answer is absolutely, positively yes, because the data points to it. Whatever is going to happen out there up in space is going to happen out there. When it does, there may or may not be consequences for us here on this planet. If so, it will not matter who saw it first, or whose theory was right, or whose belief system, agenda, notion, or pet theory is now brilliantly validated, except we want you to buy the books. So, ArcOfMillionsOfYears.com, shameless gratuity. People who are busy crapping their collective pants while running for cover are not going to be particularly interested in dishing out profuse attaboys to the I told you so crowd. They're going to be too busy dying. Consequently, no matter the consequences of whatever happens out there, up in space, surviving it all still entails the same basics: exposure, dehydration, starvation, disease, violence, etc. This is why one-ism is a fool's errand for those tricked into exploring one vacuous rabbit hole after another to the delight of anonymous disinformationalists serving the global eugenics ambitions of their masters. What a grand bargain it is for the eugenics aims of elites. As they run to their bunkers, all they need to tell everyone else is, we didn't do it. Just look up. That is, look where we tricked you into not looking in the first place. So what do we do now? Well, what do you say we go to the circus? For the sake of discussion, let's assume that a traveling three-ring circuit has come to town, and that we're now at the fairgrounds to enjoy a fun day at the circus. As we walk in from the parking lot, the dazzling allure of the sideshow first grabs our attention, brightly lit with theories spun loosely together like cotton candy. The sideshow offers the endless fun and distraction of whack-em and pop the balloons with darts and all the pop-up JPL simulators, blah, blah, blah. Oh, what a great fun it is as we marvel at the freaks and enjoy the rides. What a wonderful place to become completely distracted so that we can forget the normal cares of everyday life as we go see sci-fi movies about aliens that are eating our brains and one comet after another that's blown out of the sky by one famous actor or another. Who cares what's happening in the big tent? The real fun is in the 24/7 sideshow, because it doesn't cost anything to gawk. Like they say in Texas, anyone will stop and watch a dog fight. Then again, the big tent is really big, because after all, this is the three-ring circus, so what could be in those three rings? For those willing to pay the price of admission, they see one small side ring featuring humankind and what we're doing as a species. And the large center ring is our planet and what is happening to it, both by nature and by our own hands. And then in the other side ring is the future. And it is a bit murky right now. Or, as the Star Wars character Yoda most aptly put it, difficult to see. Always in motion, the future is. Actually, he didn't say it like that. Difficult to see. Always in motion, the future is. And where is Comet Ellen to be found in this big, magnificent circus with its entertaining sideshow and big tent? Yeah, it's down there with all the new cars. For all intents and purposes, until we can see it with a pair of 7x35 binoculars, that's the 7x35 threshold, it's somewhere between the glider coaster and the bumper cars. I like the bumper cars. A great place to be if you're looking for anything to distract you from what you need to be doing today. The bottom line is, Comet Ellen is the same as any other object in space. It doesn't matter until we all get it. Whether or not it portends catastrophic consequences for us here on Earth is subjective until that happens. In the interim, if in your mind you can only see it in the sideshow, that is where you will meet your fate. And I don't know about all this, but I can tell you that if you follow the money, if you see where the elite, the wealthy, the governments of the world are spending their money, they're not building anything long-lasting unless it's underground. All of the major computer databases are being moved to the upper Northwest. Even Microsoft is being moved to an old military installation in Moses Lake, Washington. Electricity's cheap. Most of the facilities underground in hardened bunkers. The IRS and all of its records are being moved to Colorado, high in the mountains and vaults. There are duplicate governments, government organizations with leadership set up at least a couple layers deep, with communication systems so that should Washington be taken out, there's a similar government with similar standby congressmen and similar standby super committees made of senators and state legislators. It's all set up. It's all there. And there are words being bandied about like mission essential. Mission essential means it comes off budget. It means that they can write whatever checks they want to, and they can do whatever they like to do, whatever is necessary, whatever allows them to fulfill the mandate, the task, the rules that have been given them by the voters, by the Constitution, by the law. They're doing. Russia building 5,000 new underground shelters in their cities to house their people. If you go to D.C. and ride the train, oh, you're going to be fascinated by the tunnels there. A lot of stuff going on there. There are tunnels so deep and so long in Russia and in the United States that whole sections of the cities can be housed and taken care of. I don't know if there's food storage down there, but if something happens that's going to last for a few hours or half a day and it requires us to go underground, there are places. And I've often said on this program that maybe it's time for the elite to just beat the rush. If you were in Washington, D.C. right after that earthquake and you tried to get somewhere, forget about it, people. You cross the Key Bridge and take a right-hand turn on M Street, you're not going anywhere. It'll take you an hour to go two blocks. And that was just a foreshadow of what's to come. I don't care if you're in a Mercedes. I don't care if you're in a six-door limo. You're not getting out of town. So I have a suggestion for the elites. Why don't you get in the bunkers now? Beat the rush. Get your best clothes together. Get your stuff together. Get all your accounts in order. Get all your heirs and your systems in place. Make sure the dog is fed. Make sure the house is nice and secure. It may be there when you get back. Go ahead and get in the bunkers now. Go ahead and climb in. Lock the door. And we'll take it from here. If you really want to reduce the world's population, I say the elites leave now. Go ahead and get in your bunkers now. And that will reduce the population by exactly the right amount. There are a lot of things happening in the economy. This could go anywhere. You know, the handwriting is on the wall when it comes to energy. We're going to see a continuing escalation in energy prices as the dollar weakens and global demand increases for oil. If you don't believe me, we just spent about, $100 billion to fight a three-month war in Libya. It's done now. We'll see who rises to power and what the price of oil does as we access the oil-rich fields of Libya. Since we paid most of the money to make that thing happen, and NATO was heavily involved, if you think those kids with the machine guns that were shooting up in the air and shooting walls of hotels and whatever on camera, that was a joke. Those weren't the people that fought that war. Those were teenagers with guns. Most of them got injured from shooting bullets in the ground and hurting themselves. That wasn't the ones that won that battle. They weren't riding around in Datsun pickup trucks with 50-caliber machine guns bolted in the back with 55-gallon drums cut in half and used for armor. That wasn't what won. It was NATO. It was jets and tanks and satellite telemetry that won that. That's why Mr. Gaddafi, who, by the way, is alive and well and definitely not out of power, he has plenty of followers, plenty of money. We'll see how this plays out over there. A certified energy efficiency expert, Dan, has worked with notable institutions like Sandia Laboratories and the Department of Information Agency, and is the CEO and chief engineer of Greenland Energy Dynamics. Dean reports that this young company is now seeing an explosive growth in demand for off-the-grid power systems. While his focus was originally on providing engineering and product support for businesses and wealthy homeowners seeking to get off the grid, his firm is now swamped with orders for building completely self-sustained underground bunkers for upper middle class and wealthy customers. Off-the-grid underground bunkers. According to Dean, they are building underground bunkers that are essentially comfortable, if not luxurious, underground condominiums with ample supplies of food, water, power, and so forth. Solar power, wind power, geothermal power. He's recently interviewed, and Bloomberg says terrorism can be good for bunker builders, an apocalypse can even be better for business. Danila Andreev started building panic rooms 3 years ago when fears of terrorist attacks and commercial disputes turning violent created demand in Russia. The elite use them in their houses, too. These are places where they're subject to kidnapping their kids and whatever. Maybe the mom and dad are out in Hollywood or in New York, some kind of interview or a show, and terrorists or kidnappers break into the house and try to steal the kids and hold them for ransom. There's a panic room. You simply go in the room, lock the door. You have your independent communications, power, ventilation, and a door which can hold up to an RPG. These experts are out there building these things. Now he's selling survival bunkers for as much as $400,000 each year. $400,000 each to capitalize on angst over theories the world will end next year. Believe me, people, this is exactly what we saw in the 50s and 60s. There were people in my own neighborhood that built bunkers in the basements of their houses. The same thing happened. Steel doors, food supplies, water storage, all that, same thing. He's quoted as saying, I myself am not a believer in doomsday scenarios. And I can imagine he's a believer in the revenue, though. He says, but when you start hearing clients talking about the end of the world, it gets you thinking. Northwest Shelter Systems, company based in Sandpoint, Idaho, that specializes in nuclear bomb shelters, has seen the number of inquiries from potential customers rise as much as 60% since the March tsunami and earthquake in Japan. The Vivos Group, a California-based bunker builder with a website that features a meteor striking Earth, said requests for a shelter in one of its facilities jumped by 10 times since the disaster, which left about 25,000 people dead or missing. What the revelations of Daniel Dean and his Bloomberg.com article show is that these people are spending vast amounts of money, and governments are spending money, not billions of dollars, trillions, with a T, trillions of dollars, for what cynics would call expensive black holes in the ground, presuming the future will be bright and rosy. It is also a nonsensical oddity to the media and those caught up in the one-ism sideshow, because the extent to which these people evaluate the risks is very different. It is an occasional effort, such as finding the right auto or fire insurance company to do business with. However, the reason why these people are foolishly spending their money like drunken sailors, as some would maintain, is that they get it. They know that this whole thing is a fool's errand and a reckless one at that. They understand that we live in a complex ecosystem and that it is presently under great strain. Just look at the stock market. We've had more ups and downs. I don't even know how to do an analogy of that. Brokers are making a fortune. When stocks go up and down, people are selling and buying, program trading or not. The brokers and the guys with those seats on the exchange are making an absolute rapist killing. They're making commissions in the billions. Every time the stock market goes down and people sell, they make money. Every time they turn around and buy because the prices are cheap, they make money. The only people making money are the people doing the trading. And you and I, we can't get in on that because we don't have seats on the exchange. We don't have computer trading. We can't move down to our local Fidelity office and play stocks like that. They won't allow you to do that, partly because Fidelity never actually buys the stock. They short it. sky above is not a canopy of lights, but rather a universe of grandeur and danger from many comers. Unlike the wage earners they employ or serve, they understand that being successful is more about surviving your mistakes than about being right. This needs to be the lesson of Comet Elenin. Not that we waste whatever precious time is left to us with unproductive one-ism quests, but rather that we use our time for what matters, preparation and planning for whatever comes. All we need are the basics. And by the way, it wouldn't hurt to go in the bunker building business and just take advantage of these rich elites who want to bury themselves in the ground. And I still recommend that they do it now. Come on, there's still time before it gets cold. You can take advantage of this fall. Just cash out, people. Cash out. Put the money in the bank. Go in the bunker. And we'll see you in a couple years. Okay? We'll take it from here. I think we can do a better job. Not all in the mainstream enjoy access to high-ranking members of Congress, as these bunker building risk managers do, but they're likely to have an old pair of 7x35 binoculars floating around the house. If you don't, you can buy one at Walmart for about $30. All you have to do is look out and you'll have plenty of warning, because, you know, you don't have a lot to bury in the ground. All you really need is a good backpack, an old book bag, an old pair of tennis shoes, just enough to get you around something. Don't buy new shoes and think about hiking from where you are to Cincinnati, because your feet are going to be killing you. Make sure that you take an old pair of shoes, not ones that are worn out, but ones that are worn in. Put them in that book bag. Get your 72-hour kit together. That allows you to walk for 3 days to wherever you're going to get. The average person can walk between 20 and 30 miles a day if you're pretty careful. So if you're within 100 or 200 miles of where you got to go, you can make it there in about a week without riding anything. If you have a bicycle, you might be able to get along. You know, bicycles can move along at about, anywhere from 8 to 15 miles an hour. Depends on how hard you're willing to pedal and how much stuff you have on it. You can cover a lot of ground with a bicycle. You could easily ride 50 miles a day. You could probably ride further than that if you're in decent shape. Till the tires wear out or somebody takes your bike from you because they want to go in another direction or just have what you have. What I don't recommend is buying 55-gallon drums of food storage, because if you have to leave, the food's going to stay there. I would recommend having at least two or three different layers of food storage. I would start with a 72-hour kit, a water filter, maybe some dehydrated food or MREs. MREs are kind of heavy, so you can't carry a whole lot of them. You can carry about 3 days' supply, and that's it. It's going to wear you out. Those are meals ready to eat. All the water and weight and every moisture and everything's in them. But you can mix it up. You can take the dehydrated stuff and MREs. And you can make it for, you know, MREs will take you for a whole day. One meal set will take you for a whole day if you're careful. We're talking about survival here, not eating fat and happy. We're talking about getting from one place to another. We're talking about regrouping, migrating away from a disaster of some kind. And keep in mind, if there's a comet strike, if there's a solar flare, it could be regional. But it's still going to affect the world economy, just like Katrina affected the world economy by hitting the southern coast of Texas and Louisiana. It could be regional in its effects, but it could be global in its economics. And in case you haven't looked out there, with a 9.9% unemployment rate. And by the way, if you believe that, I have beachfront property in Arizona I'd like to sell you today. That unemployment number is really probably closer to 20% in most states, and definitely in most communities. In eastern Kentucky, one out of four people is out of work. One out of four. That's worse than it was in the Depression. That's third world country status, or at least second world status. And it isn't for any other reason than lack of capital. I don't mean handouts. I don't mean that. I don't mean welfare. I don't mean unemployment. I don't mean food stamps. I'm talking about capital, the people that have ideas, people that have products that they can build and sell, that there's a demand for, people that want to go to work. There's no capital for inventory. There's no capital to get, to allow these companies to borrow the money, even if they have good credit. Banks are not loaning. You've got to free up the capital, and you've got to get it in the hands of the job creators, and if you're going to get this economy moving. 25% unemployment is not the kind of employment numbers that we're looking for here. We've got to have more than that. That's why I think it's an excellent idea for the elite to go ahead and crawl in their bunkers now, before Christmas. You won't need it. Go ahead and get in there now. We'll take it from here. We've got about 15 minutes left in the program, 530-413-4511. Anywhere toll-free, North America, 888-429-5471. By the way, the timeline on Elanin, it should be visible in about 5 days. So if you're listening to this program, August 28, 2011, we're talking 5 days. Around the 1st or 2nd of September, you should be able to see that thing with a pair of binoculars. By the 16th of November, it's going to be as close as it's going to get. By the 9th of November, that would be a week before Elanin gets to its closest point, asteroid MU55 is supposed to pass literally between the moon and Earth. Yeah, less than one lunar distance from Earth. That's like in our backyard, people. And this is a pretty good size asteroid. It's not one to be messed with. It's a couple kilometers in diameter. Coincidentally, the testing of the EAS, the Emergency Alert System, you remember the sound? Gosh, I wish I had the internet. I could play it for you right now. That most annoying sound that comes over your radio or over your television that says, right before it says, this is a test of the emergency broadcasting system. Were this an actual emergency, blah, 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 you'd be given directions, yada, yada, yada. Well, that's the emergency broadcasting system, but it's regional. Those kinds of things come out of one city or another, Atlanta, New Orleans, you know, Louisville, New York, something like that. The EAS, oh, it's quite a bit something different. The EAS is national, the entire country, and it takes over all cable channels, satellite channels, public broadcasting channels, network TV, every form of communication except cell phones. One message at one time on all levels. And the date of launch happens to be November 9th, 2011. Happens to be the same day, people. This gives the president access to the entire country at one time. There's no voluntary coverage of it. Because of ratings, Fox News is going to cover it, or ABC is going to cover it, or NBC is going to cover it, or MSNBC is going to cover it. There's no voluntary coverage of that. It's mandatory. All airwaves on all frequencies, radio, cable, TV, satellite, everything, handed over to the president at one time. The only one that won't be covered are all the internet channels, and cell phone. So they have ultimate power over the communications. What will they say on November 9th, the same day that Comet MU55 gets close to the Earth? It's hard to say. We don't know what they'll have to say. Hopefully they're not making that statement from deep beneath the Earth. We happen to notice that the CEOs of all Fortune 500 companies are not around that day. You remember reading about or hearing about events that would happen in Washington like 9/11 and others Vice President Cheney was deep beneath the earth, while President Bush handled the problem. The support, the next layer, the inheritors, the second in line, were well taken care of. Sequestered, they call it, deep beneath the earth so that they can survive. Certain congressional teams, certain senatorial teams, Speaker of the House, you know, the line of command that would take over in the event that the president should be incapacitated by some form or another. Those kinds of plans are being laid all across the country. If there's nothing to worry about, if LNN is all one big hoax, if LNN's going to be a 22 million mile away, nothing's going to happen but a small little bright fuzz ball way out in space that takes a pair of binoculars to see. If all that is just so much hooey, fog on the mirror, why are the elite building bunkers like it's going out of style? Oh, it's not contagion. Come on, the rich don't work that way. They don't all go out and buy the latest fad. They're independent thinkers. That's how they got where they are. But if every bunker building company in the country has their business expand by 1,000% in a one-year period, something's going on, people. Some kind of memo is being handed out. You didn't get a copy of it. You know, we were on RTTV the other day with Ramirez. And I got to tell you, she runs an excellent program, just an excellent presentation. And, you know, they were talking about this very subject. We talked about LNN on there, and I had to tell her, look, the evidence is kind of vacuous right now. We just don't really know if this thing's real or not yet. We don't have enough data. We're not able to find, you know, recent photos of it. JPL's evidence is kind of sketchy. On the one hand, it says it's 2 or 3 miles across. On the other hand, it says it's, you know, 3,900 miles across. That's a little difficult to put together, a little difficult for us laymen to know what's going on. And she made the comment that, you know, she hadn't had her invitation, you know, to get into the bunkers to be saved. And I facetiously said, I'm sorry, you didn't get your number. You didn't get your memo. You didn't get your pass, your ticket to get in. Not implying that I have, but I don't need it because survival is on several different levels. I'm going to survive emotionally. I'm going to survive mentally, as you are, many of you. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch the wealthy scatter while we take over the store. I think it's an interesting prospect. I don't think they're going to be able to come back up out of the ground and reclaim everything. Sorry, in your absence, we had a vote. Sorry you didn't get the memo. You might as well go back to your bunker for a while. You'll be safe there. It's going to be clean and seamless and nonviolent. No burning, no looting. We have a planet to save. I appreciate you being with me tonight here on X Squared Radio. It's been an excellent evening. Thank you so much for the many thousands of you that are out there listening. I can see that the network is full. Many of you connections are networks themselves with your own sets of listeners. Thank you for listening to X Squared Radio. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be here. Don't forget that Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is still available on Amazon. You can buy it as an e-book on Kindle or Nook. You can also buy the paperback version at rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. And when you buy from that site, you will get the audio for free. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. But you can always buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and any of the online booksellers. Excellent price. And that will ship directly from the publisher, although it will not be autographed. If you buy it from the website, you get it autographed, you get the audio version for free, and I will gladly send you information about the next book coming out. Don't forget to also watch for The Ark of Millions of Years at your local bookstore. If you're interested in purchasing that book and brush up on what's going to happen and what has happened up until now. For 2012, there are now four books out. The trilogy is on the website. The fourth book is on Amazon. It's arcofmillionsofyears.com, arcofmillionsofyears.com. We will see you here, right here, on X Squared Radio, BBS Radio Network, next week. Thank you so much.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.